could I please remind you to silence your cell phones? So welcome to the second of our lectures in our Astronomy of the 21st Century lecture series. This series is bringing to our campus some of the top leaders in the astrophysics community in celebration of our winter 2009 theme semester on the universe, Yours to Discover. And this is part of the International Year of Astronomy 2009. I'm Sally Uy. I'm from the faculty of the Department of Astronomy. And with me is Gary Foreman, the president of the Student Astronomical Society, which is a member of UAC and co-sponsoring tonight's events, together with the Exhibit Museum of Natural History and the Michigan Center for Theoretical Physics. The theme semester is really a rich program where we're offering not only lectures, but multiple exhibitions, as well as stargazing opportunities and performances and many other events. So we hope that you'll check out some of the other things that we're offering at www.lsa.umich.edu/universe. It's right up there. So tonight, we're especially honored to have with us Dr. Alan Stern, who is most recently an associate administrator for space sciences at NASA headquarters. Dr. Stern is an especially energetic individual. He has a bachelor's degree in physics and a second bachelor's degree in astronomy from the University of Texas. He has a master's degree in aerospace engineering, as well as a second master's degree in planetary atmospheres, also from the University of Texas. And he spent several years as an engineer in the aerospace industry before moving on to do his PhD in astrophysics and planetary science at the University of Colorado, which he completed in 1989. Dr. Stern since then has spent most of his career at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, where he has moved up to the ranks eventually to become executive director of their Space Sciences and Engineering Division in 2006. During his time there, they started out with about three planetary scientists, and he grew their group from that number to become one of the largest groups of planetary scientists in the world through his leadership and vision. And then, as I mentioned, in 2007 to 2008, he served as associate administrator at NASA headquarters. He is one of the foremost pioneers in trying to understand the mysterious outer reaches of our solar system, the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud and what used to be a planet but is no longer, Pluto and Charon. And in addition to being principal investigator of several instruments that have flown on NASA missions, he has also been principal investigators of the missions themselves, notably the New Horizons mission to Pluto, which is currently on its way to the outer solar system. What else can I say but that he is clearly one of the foremost leaders in our field, and we're very, very pleased to have him. I should mention that he is shortly to be going back to the Southwest Research Institute in the position of vice president.
I guess you can hear my voice. Good. Well, thank you, Sally, for a great introduction, and thank you, Gary, for dinner, and thank all the students. I've had a really wonderful day and a half visiting Ann Arbor again, and I hope you enjoy this talk. It's going to be a talk about a real revolution in planetary science. It's taken place since the 1990s, which for me seems like yesterday, and by the time this talk is over, my objective is to teach Sally what a planet is. We'll see if we succeed. But like mind shifts, you know, and revolutions cause you to have an intellectual mind shift, I thought I'd tell a story first about lawyers. Because as Sally said, I was an executive at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. I ran the Space Science and Earth Science program for NASA. It's about a third of NASA. And I had never been in the government before, except as a summer intern, as a kid in college, down at the Johnson Space Center. And when I showed up, I had to really adjust my thinking because I'd never been in a big bureaucracy with lots of conflict of interest regulations. And I remember my first day at work. It's a Monday morning, and I go to work, and I get called to a meeting with my boss, NASA administrator. Oh, good. We go upstairs and we do some planning, and I come back to my office, and there's my new office, and there's a package that's arrived. It's on my desk, Federal Express. It's one of those gift boxes, and I open it up, and it's from my old secretary, Jeanette, And it's wine and cheese and, you know, nice little note in there, you know. We miss you already. I felt homesick. And I was just feeling great. And so I went on about my business, having meetings that morning. And then about 11:30, a lawyer shows up. And he says, "I heard you received a gift." I said, "Yeah, from my old secretary." He goes, "She's not your secretary anymore. She's a contractor. And the value of that is greater than the allowance for a gift that you can receive from any corporation. It's worth about $50. So it could be considered a bribe." I said, "It's a thank you note for all the years we worked together." And he says, "Well, we're going to have to take it." I said, "Really? That's going to hurt Jeanette's feelings." And I was kind of looking forward to the cheese. And he said, "Yeah, we're supposed to take it." And I said, "Well, you know, when she sent it, I wasn't a government employee 2 days ago. Does that?" He goes, "I'll tell you what, I'll research this and I'll get back to you." That's what he said. Now, wasn't 10 minutes later, a guy named Mike Freilich, who runs the entire Earth science program for NASA, all the global change satellites, 20-something of them in Earth orbit, $1.5 billion program, comes down to my office. He now works for me. And he says, "It's your first night in town. It's the first night of Passover. What are you doing?" I said, "I don't know. I just showed up." He goes, "Well, you have to come to our house for dinner. You know, we're having Seder." I said, "Well, that's awfully nice. Sure, just tell me where." And he leaves the office, and an hour later, that lawyer shows up. This is a true story. You can't make this stuff up. And he says, "I hear Mike Freilich came by and invited you to dinner." I said, "Wasn't it nice?" He goes, "Well, he works for you." I said, "I know that." And he said, "Well, that means you set his raises." I said, "Well, I can figure that out." And he said, "Well, he's not allowed to take you to dinner." And I thought, man, am I in a different world? Am I have to change my way of thinking? And I said, "There's no way? It's just, really?" He said, I said, "Not at all." He goes, "Well, probably if you brought something, it'd be all right." I said, "You got it." I said, "Can I bring the wine and cheese?" But that actually all happened, and we ate the wine and cheese. And so I had to adjust my way of thinking, completely adjust my way of thinking to be in a bureaucracy. The story I'm going to tell you about tonight is about a large adjustment in our thinking in planetary science. Turn on the thing that advances the slides. And what I'm going to talk to you about is this complete revolution in our understanding of our own home solar system. And I like this particular little artist's view taken from beyond the position of Saturn looking back at the giant planets and then the terrestrial planets lost in the glare of the sun. And you can see the asteroid belt. And it's actually a very quaint view. It's equivalent, if you think of it as a map of our solar system, to the kinds of maps that were made of the Earth before the Pacific Ocean was known, before it was discovered, where the geography was sort of something like what you recognize, but really completely wrong. And this is a little orrery, a mechanical model of our solar system, about 100 years old, and this is what our solar system was thought to be. If you were in 1909 rather than 2009, you would know of the eight planets, the four terrestrials and the four giant planets orbiting the sun, many of them with satellites, and lots of empty space in between. And it was a very tidy and orderly world or system. And if you look at the commonalities in the planets that our great-grandparents and great-grandparents knew about. You know, you see this is a little diagram looking down on the orbits of the inner planets. The planets are far isolated from one another, lots of space in between them. They all travel in the same direction around the sun together. They're in one plane. Their orbits are nearly circular, and the space between them is empty. In fact, that's probably why it's called space. It's empty. And we all grew up with a picture very much like this, but not quite, when all of us in this room, even the school kids, many of the school kids, came to learn about planets, the view was only a little bit different. But before I tell you about how it changed, let me show you this diagram, which is a really handy way of looking at the solar system. Let's just go forward now to 1929, and this is a log-log chart. This is distance from the sun and the mass of the planets, and the distance is measured in astronomical units. One astronomical unit is the distance from the Earth to the sun. So Earth's distance is there, and 10 times that far out is here, and 100 times that far out is here. And this is mass of the planets in Earth masses. And this isn't working too well, but there's a little red dot by the one. And so the Earth is at a coordinates of 1 and 1 here, and you can see this nice... Can I use yours? I think it's going to work better. Is it up here? Oh, great. Let's see if this works better. There we go. So four low-mass planets all bunched in close to the sun. That's four terrestrial, so-called terrestrial planets. And four high-mass, 100 or so times the mass of the terrestrial planets, giant planets much farther out from the sun. Two groupings. And that's the way we saw the solar system, along with some comets and asteroids that were known at the time. But then came Clyde Tombaugh, an amateur astronomer hired by Lowell Observatory to carry out the wishes of the founder of Lowell Observatory, Percival Lowell, who had died and left some of his estate to search for Planet X. And they hired this kid, 24 years old, to come and stay up late at night in the Arizona winter and take images of the sky to look for slowly moving objects that whose motion would be indicative of being beyond Neptune. And this is the telescope that he used, a little 13-inch telescope. Put photographic plates out back, so no digital imagery in those days. He'd take the images, then he'd go develop the images, and then when it got to be the bright of the moon, that part of the month, when he couldn't take as good a data because the sky is bright, he would analyze the data he'd taken in the previous couple of weeks, and he would look for moving targets by putting two photographs into this machine called a blink comparator. And he would shift back and forth stroboscopically between them. And the stars, which don't move, just sit there as a fixed pattern. But anything that's moving will jump. And so he's looking for something that just jumps the right amount. Of course, in the foreground, there are all kinds of asteroids going through, and occasionally comets, and there are variable stars. And all this made his job harder. But he worked at it for 9 months, and he took an image that had over 40,000 stars on it in the month of January. This is a little piece out of the middle. That star, that little bright star in Gemini, has a little faint one there at 3 o'clock. And 3 days later, when he took the picture, it's over there. And that's just the right amount of jump to indicate it's a slowly moving object beyond Neptune. And he took some more data, and it continued to move along that track, and eventually convinced himself that he had really found something. And when he, you know, a good scientist is always afraid that you might make a mistake, so you want to doubt yourself and test your ideas. He took more and more data, and when he was completely convinced, he walked to his boss's office and knocked on his door at 4 o'clock one afternoon and said, "Dr. Slipher, I found your Planet X," and he had. And he became world famous. I think if People magazine had been published in 1930, he would have been on the cover. And, you know, it was a big thing. It was the American planet had been discovered. And other astronomers around the world were able to confirm it very quickly and get a bead on its orbit. And it was, in fact, far beyond Neptune. And off we go into a brave new world. The solar system, once he had found Planet 9, changed quite a bit because this planet was different from the beginning. Its orbit was egg-shaped or elliptical, and it was also tilted relative to the orbits of the other planets almost 20 degrees. So when you look at this nice diagram of the orbits, you see them all in a plane except for Pluto's, and you notice they're much more circular orbits than Pluto's. So that was different. But when you make a plot, like I showed you earlier, of the solar system and add Pluto to it, it doesn't fit the pattern. It's neither a terrestrial planet, just far out, nor is it a giant planet. It's something completely different, a low-mass planet very far from the sun. And so our view, and I suspect the view of most of you in the room, when you were taught about the architecture of our solar system, and I remember learning this in third grade from Miss Maurice, that there were four rocky terrestrial planets on the inside, four giant gas planets on the outside, and one misfit Pluto. It didn't fit any part of the pattern. And how many people in this room, just raise your hand if you can remember being taught something like that when you first learned about the solar system? Well, virtually everybody. And really that's where the story picks up, the story that I want to tell. This puzzle. Now, Pluto is very hard to study in the 20th century because it's far away and it's faint, and because it's far away, it's a tiny dot on the sky. And for the technology of the times, it was extremely difficult, but over time, slowly, even with the primitive techniques of mid-20th century astronomy by today's standards, Pluto, despite its unusual orbit, began to resemble the other planets in many key ways. It turns out to have a solid surface, very good evidence that it has a core, a centrally condensed core on the interior. By the late 1970s, it was discovered to have a moon. Now we know it has three moons. By the 1980s, we knew it has an atmosphere, that it snows on the surface. And there was definitive evidence of seasons, seasonal effects. And so in all these ways, it reminds us of particularly the terrestrial planets with solid surfaces and atmospheres and satellites and seasons. And meanwhile, off in the corner, an idea was brewing. And the idea was first actually suggested in 1930, just months after Pluto was found. Because that strange orbit caused some early astronomers, in particular an astronomer named whose last name was Leonard, to suggest that perhaps it's so different that it's one of a larger population. Maybe this isn't so much a misfit as a harbinger, evidence of something we haven't found yet, you know? Sort of like the mariners of old would know that they were approaching a shore before they could see the shoreline, when they would start to see the birds. So a number of astronomers in the middle of the 20th century came up with the same idea, but the technology didn't allow them to search for faint things very easily. The painstaking work that Tombaugh did, he really was a person of unusual concentration. And without digital computers to sift through the data, the job was just overwhelming. And on top of it, the technology to detect these faint things was not very good. And so although Leonard suggested it in the 1930s, and Edgeworth suggested it in writing, in serious journals in the 1940s, Kuiper, a giant of planetary astronomy, suggested it in the 1950s. Julio Fernandez made a much more technical argument in the 1980s based upon cometary orbits. And then in the late 1970s, his team of Duncan, Quinn, and Tremaine also made computer simulations, the orbits of comets, that suggested maybe there's a whole belt of objects that Pluto orbits in. But there was no observational evidence. And as long as it's only an idea, right, it's only an idea. Now, Kuiper, actually being such a giant in the field, got his name on this thing. And even though he was not the first to suggest it, it came to be called, in speculation, the Kuiper Belt. And that's what we call it today. And this is a nice picture. This is a book, a compendium made in 1950 of the state of astronomy at mid-century. And this is actually a book that was published at the time, and that's my copy of it. It was given to me as a birthday present by a friend of mine from graduate school. He found it in a junk sale. And Kuiper's article suggesting the Kuiper Belt lays out the story beautifully in this book. This is a picture of Kuiper at Yerkes Observatory in Wisconsin, made about the same time. And what I really like about this picture is that it's the first evidence of Kuiper's belt. You see it right there, clearly displayed. You see it wasn't such a leap for him at all. By the way, any of you who are professional astronomers may recognize this young guy. That's Chandrasekhar. Okay, so comes the 1990s. Dave Jewett and Jane Liu discovered the Kuiper Belt. A number of teams had gone out searching when the numerical simulations in the late 1980s really indicated there was something really a smoking gun in the computer simulations. It actually motivated several teams to go out and look. Jewett of MIT with his graduate student found it first. He found another object orbiting beyond Neptune in a Pluto-like orbit. That opened the floodgates because within a year, that four more had been found. And then within another year, there had been 10. And by the time 5 years had passed, 50 had been found. And today, over 1,300 Kuiper Belt objects are known. And these are generally 10,000 times fainter than Pluto, which itself is about 1,000,000 times fainter than your eye can see. And if we make a map of where all the detections of Kuiper Belt objects are to date, this is a map looking down on the solar system. So the blue circles are the orbits of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And every red or white dot out there is a known Kuiper Belt object. It's an undiscovered country, the third zone of the solar system. Completely unexpected, like the Pacific Ocean to maps the Europeans had. Now, a couple things. I said this in a talk yesterday in the astronomy department. If you see straight lines, your eye's not fooling you, though, but that's not structure in the Kuiper Belt. That's a result of the way we go look, because when an astronomer goes out, they point their telescope in one direction and do a survey for their observing run of X number of days, and so they typically will find clusters of objects along that line of sight. So that doesn't represent any structure in the Kuiper Belt. It just shows when and where they went and looked. And there's this big gap, which is not actually a gap in the Kuiper Belt. No one looks there. They don't. It's the direction of the galactic center, where there are uncountable numbers of stars that just confuse the situation, because you're looking for very faint things. And so they just don't look in the direction of Sagittarius. But there's no hole in the Kuiper Belt. Now, here's the really interesting thing. 1,300 known Kuiper Belts, 1,300 known Kuiper Belt objects so far. If you've ever looked through a long focal length telescope, you know that it's like looking through a soda straw. You just see a little tiny patch of sky at a time, right? Even the biggest format cameras we have are lucky to do something as big as your thumb at arm's length, just a little patch of sky. And so all those 1,300 Kuiper Belt objects came from searching less than 1% of the sky. It doesn't take fancy math to extrapolate. When we have finished searching the entire sky, we'll have about 100 times more than 1,300. We'll have, and the real number is about 140,000 Kuiper Belt objects out in this region of the solar system with diameters of 100 kilometers or larger. Now, 100 kilometers is like a sizable asteroid. And Pluto is gargantuan compared to that. Pluto is 2,500 kilometers across. Okay? But the first thing and the biggest change of all was the discovery that we had missed the architecture of the solar system. This is the largest structure, physical structure, in our solar system. And we completely missed it, didn't know it existed, even in the beginning of 1992. And here it is depicted as an artist might, and you see Pluto's orbit in yellow there just to illustrate. It's a big fat disk that encircles our solar system, and embedded in it are all these Kuiper Belt objects. As I say, this is the largest structure in our solar system, and it turns out these things are common. Here in Ann Arbor, one of the specialties of the astronomy department, star formation, when we look around young stars, particularly with infrared telescopes, we often see evidence of similar structures. And in fact, one nearby star, Fomalhaut, this is an image. I could have shown you other stars. This is the Kuiper Belt around Fomalhaut. So our solar system's not atypical. This kind of big structure on the outside of a planetary system turns out to be fairly common. Again, we didn't know about it until recently. And this region is dynamically complex because it's it's beyond the orbits of the giant planets and yet sculpted by their gravity in important ways. Now, I'm not going to go through this fairly technical chart. I'm using it as a prop, and I just want to show you one thing. This is a plot of orbital lifetimes. Wherever it's black, the gravity of the giant planet should have eventually, by now, over 4 billion years, evacuated the region. Black means empty in this plot. And you shouldn't find Kuiper belt objects. And wherever it's yellow, the orbits are stable for 4 billion years. And so you might expect to find objects there. And the green dots are Kuiper belt objects. And you see them in the yellow regions and not very often in the black regions. The ones that are in black regions are typically in unstable orbits, meaning they're not going to be there long on an astronomical timescale. But what's really interesting is there's not an equal number of green dots everywhere that it's yellow. Look at this little place right here where there's so many of these things all piled up. It turns out that's a very special orbit. That's an orbit that goes around twice every time Neptune goes around three times. It's called a resonant orbit. It's a mean motion resonance with Neptune. That's the kind of orbit that Pluto's in. And it turns out Pluto's got a lot of friends. It's got a big cohort orbiting with it, not flying in formation like a bunch of jet fighters, but orbiting similarly, very similarly. And this complex dynamics actually was a clue to something else we had completely missed in solar system astronomy. Because the way that so many objects pile up in these resonances is by sweeping the resonances like a rake across the solar system. How would you do that? The pileup of objects in these resonances is strong forensic evidence that in the early solar system, the orbits of the giant planets migrated, in Neptune's case, probably a billion miles out. And so slowly, the giant planets were changing their location. We had always assumed, we didn't know any better, that when you find a planet in an orbit, that's where it was born. Turns out not so. The entirety of the outer solar system, all four of the giant planets, now known as the middle zone of the solar system, has migrated. But we couldn't tell it from looking at where these giant planets are now. It took the discovery of this third zone of the Kuiper belt and the map of their orbits to provide that forensic evidence. And it was a completely foreign concept as recently as the mid-1990s that planets migrate. And yet now when we look around other stars, we see evidence of planetary migration over and over and over again. Second revolution that came as a result of the discovery of Pluto and later its cohort in the Kuiper belt. But the third revolution was the discovery that Pluto is not just accompanied by a lot of other objects out there, that there are a large number of small planets that orbit with Pluto. And these are actual Kuiper belt objects shown to scale with Pluto. There's one that's a little bit larger. Actually, we now know it's not so large as it appears. It's only about 10% bigger than Pluto. But these are various Kuiper belt objects. Some of them have names. Some of them just have numbers and license plates at this point. Some have satellites, the same way that Pluto does. Some are red like Pluto. Some are grayer. Some are bright and icy. Okay? This is completely unexpected. When you learned astronomy in grade school or graduate school, if you didn't learn it in this decade, you didn't learn what I'm about to tell you. Our solar system is really good at making large numbers of small planets, right? Pluto the misfit no more, right? It's part of a big cohort of small planets. We like to call them dwarf planets. I particularly like to call them dwarf planets because I coined the term in a paper in Icarus in 1991 in analogy to the term in stellar astronomy, dwarf stars. You know, the sun is a dwarf star. And we have giant stars and dwarf stars, and I thought, well, since we have giant planets, and this paper was predicting that we would find a large number of small planets in the Kuiper belt someday, if then we hadn't discovered the Kuiper belt, but it was suggesting that the Kuiper belt would have a large number of small planets. It turns out it does. It turns out if you do the calculation, the total number of planets in the solar system is less like 9 and more like 900, which is quite a revolution. Now, what are these small planets? Well, what they literally are planetary embryos. We know that planets form by growing from small things into bigger and bigger things. And if you make a computer simulation, a state-of-the-art computer simulation of planet formation, and you drop Plutos, Pluto-sized objects, into the simulation at the distance of the Kuiper Belt, in a disk where Pluto could grow, in the kind of disk that has enough, astronomers call it surface mass density, but let's just say enough material out there to grow a Pluto before the disk can dissipate, you find that at the time it's Pluto's size, it is gobbling up material very, very fast, and its doubling time scale is very short, and in the astronomical blink of an eye, the snap of your fingers, a Pluto left in that feedstock would grow to Earth size. So why are these small? Because the feedstock was removed. Something happened early in the history of our solar system when the third zone, the Kuiper Belt, was growing planets in huge numbers that removed all the feedstock. We're not sure what that was. There are some hypotheses. And in question and answer time, we can talk about that if you like. But something removed all the feedstock, terminated their growth, aborted their evolution, if you would, so that they were literally frozen in mid-gestation. And that's what we see today, these planetary embryos. And that's one of the reasons planetary science put a mission to Pluto at the top of its list, because here we have an opportunity to see frozen in time the early stages of planet formation. It's the equivalent of, say, a paleontologist being able to find not just the bones of the dinosaur, but the bones of the dinosaur fetus and learn about the development. But that's sort of another story. So we have this big population of dwarf planets in our solar system. Now, these are pictures of asteroids. And I suspect they don't look to you when you first look at them very much like planets. And I think I know why, because they're lumpy. And if I passed out a sheet of paper to every person in the room and said, draw me a picture of a planet, I suspect that every one of you on turning that piece of paper in would start with a circle, because you know that. It's not that hard. Planets are spherical. And I've actually done this in school classrooms. Kids never turn in. When I say, draw a picture of a planet, I get lots of stuff, lots of colors, and some have clouds and rainbows and smiley faces, but I never get a triangle back. I never get a square, a rectangle, a trapezoid. I never get anything but round things, because the kids know what's important is when things get big, they can't be lumpy. These are the same asteroids, some of them 40 miles across, compared to Pluto, an artist's conception. Okay? So when we talk about dwarf planets, these are still very large objects by comparison to asteroids, common run-of-the-mill asteroids like the ones we send spacecraft to. Okay? Those are all those same asteroids that look so big here that are actually really tiny compared to all these dwarf planets. Now, however, the dwarf planets are small compared to the big, big, giant planets. There are all 9 planets that were known before the discovery of the Kuiper Belt to scale. Pluto's the smallest of them. You see, Earth's not very big. And there's Uranus and Neptune. They're pretty big. And Saturn and Jupiter are just gargantuan. So there's a lot of scale in there. But, you know, that's what's so neat about astronomy is there's lots of scale in many things in astronomy. Let's take a look at stars. So here are some stars that you know about. Included in that group is the sun. It is one pixel right there. Nobody ever says, well, it's not a star, right? Dwarf stars aren't stars, right? Never. No, it's too small to be a star. No, it actually does what stars do, nuclear fusion in the interior. So we're sure it's a star because that attribute defines stars. So no longer is Pluto a misfit. We know small planets litter our solar system. And our new view is 4 terrestrial planets, 4 giant planets, and 1,000 dwarf planets. Guess who's the misfit now? And what makes these guys different? Well, they're smaller. A lot more of them. That shakes some people up. People don't like being their notions of what the world is about to suddenly change. Even scientists are people, too. Often their orbits are different, too. They follow crazy paths, elliptical or more inclined. But except for that, not much. In fact, if you ask what do small planets have in common with their larger cousins, it's a lot like what was learned in the mid-20th century about Pluto. It turns out they form similarly to the Earth through the same kinds of accretion processes. They're made of rock and ice, just like Earth and Mars, rock like Venus and Mercury. They have moons like other planets. They have cores like all the larger planets. Some, in fact, many, show evidence of atmospheres. Their surfaces are solid. Many of them are expected to have geologic activity. So as this slide says, simply put, the small planets have no distinguishing characteristics from larger planets, except that they are small. I like to say, you know, you've got to get over it. A chihuahua's still a dog. There's something deeper going on. That's why it's a dog. It shares that genetic material that makes it have certain attributes that we all agree is in the species. So, I don't think Sally knew she was anticipating part of the topic of this, but I want to talk about planet classification because this has been thrust upon us by new data. It's great. This is how science works. Is even when you have a nice, tidy model, sometimes data disrupts your thinking. We thought the solar system was four terrestrial planets, four giant planets, and footnote, misfit Pluto. Turns out, it's actually completely upside down. When we could peer into the deep outer solar system, we discovered this giant structure of the Kuiper Belt that is littered with small planets. Not nine, more like 900. And so now we have to readjust our classification. Now, if you ask what are the typical classification schemes, there's a lot of papers around, a lot of people talk about it, but it really breaks down, there are two ways you can do it, or there are two ways that people have been talking about it. One is dynamical, based upon their orbits, primarily, and one is what I call intrinsic, or based upon an object's attributes. And I'm going to talk about both of those. But before I do, I just want to make a couple, you'll be able to see where I'm going. Let's just talk about classification based on dynamics, or location, rather, and intrinsic properties. So let's start with something really simple. For the kids in the audience, do we judge a house, a home, based on its location? Some of these locations, we would say, are houses, and perhaps based on location, you would say, some aren't. Because, you know, I'm from the country, and I only have seen a few houses, and they never come in big groups, in large numbers. So maybe those aren't houses. Or do we base them, what's a house, based on its attributes? You know, it's typically a structure that human beings live in that have certain things in common, such as a roof, and usually a kitchen, and a place to sleep, and maybe some other rooms. I suspect most people here would agree that a better classification scheme for judging houses would be based on its attributes rather than whether it's in the city or in the country or whether it's in a big group or all by itself. You can ask that question about astronomy. In all branches of astronomy that I'm aware of, when we classify what kind of object an object is, it turns out to be based on its attributes. Stars are stars because they burn material with nuclear fusion. And we do not ask where the star is or what orbit it's in. Is it in a galaxy or not? It doesn't matter. Is it in the field or not? It doesn't matter. Is it in a cluster or not? It doesn't matter if there are more stars around it. It doesn't even matter if stars orbit stars. If you have a triple system, fine. Those are all stars. So enter the International Astronomical Union in 2006 that decided to grapple with the issue of planet classification, and in my opinion, in the opinion of many planetary scientists, made a royal mess of it. And then put out press releases, and next thing you know, it's all over the papers in August of 2006. And so they wanted to classify planets for a simple reason. The IAU is a big bureaucracy with about 10,000 members, professional astronomers, most of them people that work on stars and galaxies, very few people that work on planets. But the IAU has a series of committees called commissions. And there were two commissions that were arguing about which one would get to name these new things being discovered in the Kuiper Belt. There was no commission for naming planets because we thought we'd run out of planets after discovering Pluto. Okay, but there was a commission for asteroids and comets and a commission for other small bodies. And they're having an arm wrestle over who gets to name the baby. And so this is the compromise position. And you know, when a committee writes something, it usually doesn't work out very well. They defined that a planet shall have three attributes. To be a planet, it has to be a celestial body. Now, that's good. It should be in space. That is in an orbit around the sun. Now, already they've screwed up because all of the planets around other stars are immediately excluded. Okay. Maybe we can overlook that as sloppy, even though sloppy is not hip in science. Second, it has to have sufficient mass so that it assumes hydrostatic equilibrium, which will make it nearly round. That's the property, that's the reason that planets become round, is you pour in enough mass and eventually the gravity overwhelms the material strength. And they try to reach what scientists call a minimum potential energy shape. And that'll be a sphere, or a sphere elongated by its rotation, flattened a little bit. So that's good. They got generally the right idea. It's got to have a minimum size. It's got to be big enough to at least be round due to gravity, not just round. So if I were to take in the room here, if I were to take this and carve it until it's round, that wouldn't make it a planet because it wouldn't be in hydrostatic equilibrium. They've got the right idea. It's got to be massive enough that its shape is determined by gravity. And then they threw the monkey wrench in and has cleared the neighborhood around its orbit. Because this is back to the old idea that planets are in isolated orbits. And since the IAU was grappling between these different committees, and the committee that won the debate, the argument for who gets to name the baby, was made up of dynamicists. They wanted a dynamical sieve that would eliminate all the small bodies from planets so that they would fall into the Small Bodies Commission so they could name them. Okay, so if you look at Pluto's orbit being egg-shaped, it crosses the orbit of Neptune. And this eliminates Pluto from contention as a planet and other Kuiper Belt objects as well, even if they're large, like Pluto, and big and round. Now, that's got some problems with it, and we're going to talk about those. It's really the neighborhood clearing that's the problem because it's based on location. It has nothing to do with what kind of body it is. Further, you can very quickly write down an equation for how massive an object has to be to clear its zone. You do a rough back of the envelope thing on a blackboard. And you find that the critical mass, shown here as mass PL for mass of a planet, depends upon things like the gravitational constant. Okay, that's just the number. The age of the system, the mass of the star, and how far out the orbit is. Let's just talk about that for a minute. So what that means, if you're not into equations, is that this equation fundamentally biases, that definition biases against distant planets. Because in order to qualify to be massive enough to clear the zone, the further out you go, the more and more massive the object has to be. So if you were to take our solar system and start swapping which objects were in which orbits, you'd get different answers as to which ones are planets or not. In fact, the Earth's not always a planet in this scheme. Now, I don't think that passes the smell test. I think that's where I have to draw the line. This is not so hard. You know, sometimes people can make something simple hard. And this is a case because I don't know how many people in the public really realize this, but by the IAU's definition, if you were to run up in a spacecraft, say Captain Kirk, Starship Enterprise, shows up around a new planet, turns on the viewfinder, this is what they see. Now, I used to watch Star Trek as a kid, and Kirk would turn to Spock and say, "Mr. Spock, what class planet is it?" And he looked in that viewfinder. I don't know what he was looking at, but he'd look up in a few seconds and say, "Class M planet." And if they saw Earth, he would answer with something like that, because the moment you see it, you know it's a planet. Ah, but not in the 23rd century world of the IAU. Mr. Spock, what type object is it? He's looking at the Earth. Spock replies, Captain, we're going to have to take some more data. I'm going to have to find out all the other objects that orbit in the solar system. Then I'm going to have to feed their orbits into my computer. They're going to integrate overnight. I'm going to tell you which ones have cleared their zone. I'll get back to you in the morning. I don't think so. Now, my friend and colleague Hal Levison, who got his PhD here in Ann Arbor, here at the University of Michigan, made this nice plot for me. He's a dynamicist, and it's complicated. And I don't want to go into the details of it in this audience, but there are different ways an object can clear its zone. It can clear its zone by different physical processes, but suffice to say that in order to clear its zone, it must be below both these red and blue lines. And if you put the Earth, that's a one Earth mass object, I'm using the wrong one again, sorry, put a one Earth mass object at the location of Pluto, Earth can't be a planet. It couldn't clear Pluto's zone. So the argument that Pluto is not a planet because it can't clear its zone would eliminate any Earth-sized object in the Kuiper Belt. And in fact, further out in the Oort cloud, even a Jupiter would not qualify. Because as you go further and further out, the volume is going up like the cube of the distance. So there's a lot more zone to clear. So it takes a much more and more massive object to do this job, so massive that you would have to actually cross the boundary of brown dwarfs into stars in the Oort cloud. No object in the Oort cloud, by this definition, could be a planet. Even if we had sent a spacecraft to it and found it had continents and mountains and oceans and it was the exact same size as the Earth or Neptune or Jupiter, it would not qualify. I submit to you this is a poor way of going about it. Now, planetary scientists tend to like another definition. It's called the geophysical planetary definition. It's based only on attributes, not where an object is, but what it is. And it's sort of similar, but it's a little simpler. It's a celestial body, good, that has sufficient mass so that it can assume hydrostatic equilibrium and become round due to gravity, or overwhelming material strength, not so big that it starts doing fusion and becomes a star. Pretty simple. Pretty relaxing by comparison. Now, this embraces the diversity of the discoveries that we're making, in addition to being simple. It does not rely on having a complete census of a system, so that when you find something that you think, oh, it's two Earth masses, you can say, that's a planet. I don't have to know anything about any of the other orbits, because the orbits don't matter. And objects don't reclassify if you just change which one's in which location. All the classification in this scheme is based entirely on their nature, not their location. After all, we all know location is for realtors, right? Location, location, location. And Hal Levison, same guy, Michigan grad, made this plot, and it shows in our solar system this green dividing line between what's a planet above, because it'll be big enough to be round, and what's not a planet below. And the numbering scheme, the key is over here. So that's the Earth, Mercury, planet number one, Venus, planet number two, Earth, planet number three. Some of the satellites of Jupiter, which are planet-sized worlds, are big enough to qualify. That's fine. Where is number nine? There's Pluto. It turns out to be about a factor of 10 bigger and about 1,000 times more massive than the minimum criteria to satisfy this definition. Now, in this definition, anytime you find an Earth, it's going to pass the test. And the thing is, you're going to have to get used to large numbers of planets and solar systems in this way. Okay. Well, I can just use this. We're 2-3 slides from the end. Will this create a feedback? Not if you turn. There we go. Okay, so I want to recapitulate. I'm coming to the end. The discovery of Pluto led to a revolution 70 years later. The first part of that revolution was the discovery of the Kuiper Belt, the third and largest zone of our planetary system, previously unsuspected. Then the discovery that planets migrated from their formation sites, again, completely unexpected.
And finally, the discovery that there is a third class of planet in our system called the dwarfs, which dominate the population of our solar system. We had it completely backwards. And just like in the days of Copernicus, when the Copernican revolution took place and upended the Earth from the center of the universe, we have again been displaced. It's the Earth-like planets that are the misfits. It's the ice dwarfs out in the Kuiper Belt that are typical. So I have to say, I think somewhere Copernicus is smiling. Thank you very much. And just one final comment. This is something I spoke about yesterday. The United States launched a mission called New Horizons to Pluto in the Kuiper Belt in 2006. And I have the privilege of leading that mission scientifically. And the exploration of the Kuiper Belt begins on Tuesday, July the 14th, Bastille Day in 2015. Stay tuned. Okay, and I'll take your questions if there are any. And Sally's asked me to repeat your questions.
You mentioned briefly the Oort cloud. Is there a natural delineation between the Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud, or is it just a continuum of mass that goes out from...
It's actually a continuum. It blends from one to the other. And any dividing line would be arbitrary, just as we make an arbitrary dividing line between where the Gulf of Mexico stops and the Atlantic Ocean starts, but nature doesn't make that dividing line.
Up in the back.
Yes, please speak up. Well, that's not addressed by the IAU definition in either respect, because anything outside our solar system can't be a planet. Now, in the geophysical planet definition, it says that it can never do fusion. And one of the characteristics of a brown dwarf is that it briefly did low-temperature fusion of deuterium in its interior. So brown dwarfs are excluded in the geophysical planet definition as sort of quasi-wannabe, some people call them failed stars. Since I like planets better than stars, I call them failed planets. But nonetheless, they wouldn't count.
Yes.
Which one? Yes. Yeah. So the question is, how much mass is in the Kuiper Belt today? And we can estimate that from counting up all the Kuiper Belt objects, estimating their size, guessing their density, doing the arithmetic, and the answer comes out to be very little mass. The Kuiper Belt has much less than an Earth mass of material in it today. However, we also know that it had to form in an environment that had many Earth masses of feedstock in order to get the growth that we already see. So something changed radically. Something removed all that material from the Kuiper Belt in the early days. We're not sure what. Yes, instead of going forward, backward, I'll go forward. and I have a few other slides. And if you use the geophysical planet definition that today the census gives you 20 planets in the solar system, two-thirds of which are dwarfs, and you see their names there. What was your second question? No, I should make one of those. That would be a good idea. Yeah. What I meant, and I suppose I wasn't clear, the question was, the gentleman was pointing out that there's a difference that he knows about between the Kuiper Belt planets and the terrestrial planets and the giant planets, that the Kuiper Belt planets have orbits that are more inclined and elliptical. That's true, but it's not an intrinsic property of the objects. It's just how they orbit. Now, the reason they are in more elliptical and inclined orbits is really simple. They're further from the sun, so the sun's gravity is less strong out there, and so it's easier to get into an elliptical or inclined orbit the further and further you go from the star. In fact, I'll tell you that even if we had Earth's and Uranus's and Neptune's and Jupiter's much further out, they're likely going to be in elliptical inclined orbits. It's just the nature of being out there in the suburbs where the sun's gravity isn't on such a tight string that holds you to the central plane and a more circular orbit. So that's a characteristic of being far away, not what kind of object it is, whether it's an asteroid, comet, planet, or even another star that were to orbit in the far reaches, it would probably be on an elliptical inclined orbit. Next. Yes, in fact, we do. Just as stars orbit stars, these objects that are moons because they orbit planets are the large ones, like Ganymede and Titan, are planets of their own right. One of them, by the way, called Triton, a Pluto-sized moon of Neptune, is known to be captured. It used to orbit the sun. It just got snared by Neptune. So really, that's just another location thing. If a planet's orbiting another planet, that's just part of its location. And it's really not an intrinsic property. And that's the way I see it going in planetary science among practitioners who actually work on planets, not stars or galaxies, is to look at the intrinsic properties of an object. And it doesn't matter where we find it, what orbital circumstance. Take a look at this list in green. Satellite planets count, like Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto, Titan, Triton, and Luna, our moon.
Thereby need a definition also for what a moon is, from what you're extrapolating. The implication is you would need a definition for what a moon is as well.
Yes, a moon is an object orbiting a planet, whether small or large. If it's large enough to be a planet, it just happens to be a planet as well. No, the moon, how did you said, the question was, so the Earth is a moon? Actually, the Earth is not orbiting the moon. Yes, and that common barycenter, very good point, the barycenter of the Earth-Moon system is inside the Earth. And so, by technical standards, it's not a double planet. The moon orbits the Earth. Now, in the case of Pluto and Charon, the barycenter is actually between the two bodies. And so they orbit this common point in space, and that is a double planet. And there are several other double planets known in the Kuiper Belt. The exotica that we're going to be discovering with this new technology, I think, is just going to continue to rock our socks. Who's next? I don't understand it. I'm sorry.
The sun
Yes, the sun has an axis of rotation. The sun's equator is almost precisely aligned with the orbits of the inner planets and the giant planets. So our orbit and the orbits of Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune are roughly in the equatorial plane of the sun.
Let's just take one or two more. Yes.
Ah. I don't plan to take it to the IAU, nor do any colleagues that I know of. Over the last 3 years, the IAU just keeps continuing to dig this hole deeper for itself. The great thing about this group, the IAU, is that it has no police force. They are not the Supreme Court. Astronomy, like other sciences, does not work by voting. Voting works really well in a democracy, but in science, it matters not one whit. If all the scientists in the world tomorrow voted unanimously that the sky is green, it wouldn't make it so. That's not how science works. Science works by finding the best model, and then because other scientists will simply gravitate to that model because it works best, scientists vote with their feet. They don't vote by raising their hand and taking a count. Okay, how many people don't believe in the theory of continental drift? Oh, more than half. Continental drift's bull. Doesn't work that way. And so the IAU is just looking sillier and sillier as the American Geophysical Union, the American Association of the Advancement for Science, the European Geophysical Union, all these organizations much bigger than the IAU by population, are all having meetings on planet definition and planet classification, which I submit to you is empirical evidence that the scientific community, not everyone, but many, just don't like what the IAU came up with, and they're just moving on. The IAU can catch up later if it like. I think you want to take one more, two more?
One last one.
A few years ago, there was some
Yeah, so the gentleman asked a question about some of the very distant Kuiper Belt objects that have extreme orbits pose a quandary. How did the orbits get so elliptical and in some cases detached from the Kuiper Belt? And one of the suggestions that he had heard about in the scientific literature is that a star passed close to the sun and elongated those orbits with its gravity. And he asked if there had been any more work on it. A little bit. But it's also been shown, and we don't know which is right or if there's a third idea that'll come later, that it's possible to get Sedna into its current orbit other ways. In fact, that was work done by Hal Levison, who's this Michigan graduate that I spoke about earlier. It's just that it's a very rare occurrence that the other dynamical channels will result in a strange orbit like that. But it is a real puzzle for us, and as we look deeper and deeper into our solar system, we find more and more things that are just bizarre, and we're just learning to grapple with that. It's unnerving to scientists to find these kind of orbits when we didn't expect them, these kind of objects when we didn't expect them, these numbers of objects when we didn't expect them, but you know, that's what science is. It adapts to new data, and so we're in this great transition period, this great revolution in planetary science, where it's emerging really from a 19th century view to a 21st century view. And it's a really exciting time to be in the field. I'm sorry we don't have time for more questions, but thank you for coming tonight.
People will come down and speak with you a bit more. I just wanted to remind you that we will have, are we observing tonight or? Yes? Okay, Jessica says it's thumbs up, so if you would like to go observing at Angel Hall, please gather at that door with the Student Astronomical Society. And I did also want to mention, as a former employee of Lowell Observatory, that there was great consternation about what Percival Lowell would think about the change in status of Pluto, and I'm sure he would now be thrilled. So thank you so much for coming, and please come to our next lecture and check out the theme semester events. Those of you who would like to visit with Dr. Stern for a few more minutes are welcome to do so.